From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Lenny Kaye is the guitarist in Patti Smith's band and the producer of the famous garage band anthology Nuggets. But his new book is the story of the 1930s crooner Russ Colombo, whose records have made Kaye think differently about his own music. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Kaye about crooners, and he'll perform a couple of songs from that era. Also, Russell Banks talks about his new novel about a former member of the 60s radical group The Weather Underground, who goes to West Africa, marries a Liberian, and gets caught in that country's civil war. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The United Nations Nuclear Watchdog Agency confirmed today that nearly 380 tons of powerful explosives are missing from an Iraqi weapons site south of Baghdad. The conventional high explosives were stored at a facility that Saddam Hussein used for nuclear weapons research. The International Atomic Energy Agency says it warned the Bush administration to secure the site both before and after the U.S.-led invasion, but that security at the site was poor. A Pentagon spokesman said today that explosives are widely available all over Iraq and that it's too soon to know what happened to the missing material. The IAEA says it informed the U.S. that the explosives were missing earlier this month. Former President Bill Clinton joined the campaign of Senator John Kerry today, making his first appearance on the stump since undergoing heart surgery last month. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
Bill Clinton campaigned alongside Kerry today at a rally in Philadelphia that drew tens of thousands of supporters to the city's Love Park. Clinton joked that the enthusiastic welcome did his heart good after last month's bypass surgery. He said he was proud of the way his fellow Democrat, John Kerry, has run his campaign.
In the closing days of this election, and you know I've been home watching it, so I see all this stuff. The other side, they're trying to scare the undecided voters about Senator Kerry.
Clinton said when one candidate appeals to fears and the other candidate appeals to hopes, voters are better off choosing the candidate who wants them to hope. Clinton will take that message to another battleground state, Florida, tomorrow. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Philadelphia.
President Bush assailed Senator Kerry today, accusing the Democratic nominee of having the wrong strategy on terrorism for the wrong country. Nancy Greenlease of member station KUNC reports from Greeley, Colorado.
Mr. Bush used his appearance in this overwhelmingly Republican agricultural community to unveil a terrorism speech. He had a welcoming audience in a crammed field house filled with more than 8,000 people, all of whom declared their support for the president to gain entrance. President Bush blasted Kerry for seeking global cooperation and lacking the leadership to be a wartime president.
Our country will not sit back and wait for future attacks. We will prevent those attacks by going after the enemy.
Mr. Bush also made a direct appeal to Democrats to cross party lines. He won Colorado in 2000, but John Kerry has kept the state competitive this election. For NPR News, I'm Nancy Greenlease in Greeley, Colorado.
Stock prices showed little change today on Wall Street. The Dow lost 7 points to close at 9,750 in active trading of more than 1.3 billion shares. The Nasdaq was down a point to 1914. This is NPR News. The Supreme Court announced today that Chief Justice William Rehnquist has thyroid cancer. It said the 80-year-old Chief Justice underwent a tracheotomy over the weekend, but said he expected to return to work next week. The Chief Justice's illness drew attention to the likelihood that the winner of next week's presidential election will appoint one or more new justices to the nation's highest court. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon has opened a two-day debate on his plan for an Israeli withdrawal from Gaza. Sharon said a pullout would strengthen Israel. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
Sharon said the decision to pursue a unilateral pullback from Gaza was the most difficult he had made in his entire life as a soldier, a politician, and as prime minister. He appealed directly to the settlers, telling them, quote, "You are wonderful people, but you have one weakness. A messianic complex has evolved among you." Sharon said he is determined to proceed with the pullout, which he has said in the past will begin next May. As expected, the debate in the Israeli parliament was stormy, with hardline Knesset members repeatedly interrupting the prime minister. Four right-wing Knesset members were ejected from the plenum. The Knesset votes on the plan tomorrow, and it is expected to get a majority. Linda Gradstein, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Doctors say Palestinian Authority President Yasser Arafat does not appear to be suffering from any major illness. The 75-year-old Arafat underwent minor exploratory surgery today at his headquarters compound in the West Bank city of Ramallah. The surgery was performed after the Palestinian leader complained about a stomach ailment. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, providing innovative approaches to food and facilities management services throughout North America. On the web at SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Lenny Kaye has played guitar with Patti Smith's band since she started performing 30 years ago, and he produced the influential garage band anthology Nuggets. But his latest work is a book about the 1930s crooner Russ Colombo and his contemporaries Bing Crosby, Rudy Vallee, and Al Jolson. It's called You Call It Madness, The Sensuous Song of the Croon. We invited Lenny Kaye to talk with us about his new interest in crooners and to perform a couple of his favorite songs from the era. Let's start with Russ Colombo's recording of Prisoner of Love.
Alone tonight you'll find me. Too weak to break the chains that bind me. I need no shackles to remind me. I'm just a prisoner of love. For one command I stand and wait now, from one who's master of my fate now. I can't escape, for it's too late now. I'm just a prisoner of love. What's the good of my caring if someone is sharing those arms with me? Although she has another, I can't have another, for I'm not free. She's in my dreams, awake or sleeping, upon my knees to her I'm my very life is in her keeping. I'm just a prisoner of love.
That's Russ Colombo, recorded in 1931. Lenny Kaye, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, you're famous for playing with Patti Smith and for loving garage bands. What sent you back to the 20s and 30s, to early pop?
Well, I feel like I was sent there for a reason. I don't really know why. I was driving along one night, and I heard the story of Russ Colombo on the radio. It was pretty random. And he piqued my imagination. I was attracted to the circumstances of his passing, which were somewhat tabloid, and I liked the song, and I thought, well, here's someone I don't know anything about. What's his story? In a way, I feel like he chose me, actually, and the deeper I got into it, the more I felt like this was a period of music that wasn't recognized for the effect it had on the rest of music. It was kind of almost the beginnings of modern-day popular music. The microphone had just been invented. This kind of soft, intimate singing was possible, and the singing was very sensual, and it appealed to my sense of, curviness, I guess. In a sense, it's the same attraction that one has to rock and roll, only one, you know, it's a lot louder. Rock and roll is a lot louder and more energetic. And I have to say there was some attraction in the fact that it was in rock and roll, that it was something new, that it was kind of a world that I could go to whenever, you know, I could feel the tintinnabulation in my ear. It was kind of different.
I'm going to ask you to read a short excerpt from your new book. You call it Madness. And this is, you know, a little bit about the newness of the microphone and how that was changing things.
Mm-hmm. The Romeo of song. Nothing too fast, mind you. All tempos decelerated for slow and sinuous dancing. A music for whispering in ears. For sliding out the slots in the bakelite, a glowing dial, and the warm, crackling, static hum of electricity. Russ didn't know about electric instruments. They hadn't been invented yet. Mere rumors and prototypes, if you didn't count the microphone. And he did, because it allowed him to sing softly, to mouth each word as it came out of his mouth, to send it just toward you, you, just the way you always wanted to hear it and experience it, how you always wished it would be, head back, eyes lidded, hand pressed inside your thigh, to reach that one moment of total real-time bliss in which something meaningful passes back and forth between your heart's flutter, to know how deep love can stick its tongue in your ear.
So you really got to thinking about what it was like to be a singer when the microphone was first invented and singing was changed forever.
And let's not forget when the radio was first invented.
Right, right.
I mean, this was a way, it kind of was, you needed both to suddenly create a sense of intimacy and going into people's homes and going into their private lives, essentially. It's not so different from what you do, Terry.
Without the singing. There's one line in your book, you write, the microphones hide in the shrubbery in the foreground. There's something shameful about their presence, that they must be disguised to preserve an illusion. Were microphones often hidden early on?
Well, especially in films, you know, they were somewhat controversial, and I'm sure that the quality of microphone technology at the time was a little squawky. But it was regarded as somewhat artificial in the same way that electric guitars, when they came along, were regarded as somewhat, you know, they weren't real. They weren't like acoustic instruments. I think part of the 20th century is understanding how important electricity is to the sound and texture of the times and the music that was created as a result of it.
Well, you've been performing with Patti Smith around the world lately, and you have Patti Smith has a new CD that you're on. But how mm-hmm. has listening to crooners and writing about crooners changed the kind of performing you're doing on your own?
Well, for one, it awakened me to a lot of chords that rock and roll kind of sidesteps over. These songs are very complex. Some of the passing notes and passing tones are things that rock and roll kind of blew by in its quest for the classic 1-4-5 progression.
I'm really glad you say that, because so many people like dismiss the early pop of the 20s and 30s as being simple, Tin Pan Alley, Moon, June, Spoon. And musically,
well, simple,
yeah,
there's hardly.
Some pretty, yeah, thank you.
I mean, it takes me about a month to learn these songs, let me tell you. I try to get all the little inner chords.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it also helps you see it from the other side, what rock and roll must have looked like to people like, for instance, Les Paul or Bing Crosby, who kind of honed their craft in a different time. And then you have all these kids coming up with a very simplistic, almost common denominator sense of melody and texture. And, you know, you could see that it was probably very shocking to them. I like seeing it from both ends. To me, what this book really helped me do is knit together pre-rock. I was pretty good starting in the late 40s, understanding how rock and roll grew. But to take it back to the turn of last century was really quite an adventure. And you also begin to realize that the people who made this music, Bing Crosby, Rudy Vallee, Russ Colombo, were as crazy and as driven and as scandalous in some ways as, you know, any rock star myth that you have. They weren't throwing televisions out the hotel windows because they hadn't been invented yet, but I'm sure when Bing Crosby had a snootful, he tossed a radio out at least.
Well, you brought your guitar with you, for which I thank you very much. Would you perform one of the songs that you've been listening to that one of the crooners made famous?
Well, the first, when I started learning this music and the people and the names and the characters and the great songs, I was especially drawn to what became Bing Crosby's theme song, Where the Blue of the Night Meets the Gold of the Day. And in the book, there's a really nice little event where Russ Colombo, even though he knows that Bing is ready to choose it as his theme song, decides to get the jump on Bing and record it 5 days before Bing records his version, resulting in the justly legendary Battle of the Baritones, which, if you lived in America in 1931, was, your great feud, Bing versus Russ, at a time when Russ and Bing were probably neck and neck, and it wasn't apparent who was going to win the race to be America's most romantic singer. Where the Blue of the Night Meets the Gold of the Day, a truly, truly, truly beautiful song. Where the blue of the night meets the gold of the day, someone waits for me, and the gold of her hair crowns the blue of her eyes like a halo, tenderly. If only I could see her, oh, how happy life could be. Where the blue of the night meets the gold of the day, someone waits for me. Why must I live in dreams of the days I used to know? Why can't I find real peace of mind and return to the long ago? Ba 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 ba. If only I could see her, oh, how happy life could be. Where the blue of the night meets the gold of the day, someone waits for me.
Done by Lenny Kaye. That was wonderful. I really enjoyed that.
It's really, it's a beautiful music, and it's just a real honor and pleasure to be able to learn it and to place oneself in that time. I mean, when I was working on the book, I spent a lot of time in the library just kind of familiarizing myself with that moment, late 20s, 1928, 29 to 34, and I could, get all the tabloid scandals, the murder mysteries. It was really fun. It was a time of the Lindbergh kidnapping. It was television had just kind of come over the horizon, though it wasn't there yet. The silence were moving into the talkies, resulting in much upheaval in Hollywood. The Ziegfeld Follies were kind of in their final glory. It was a really marvelous time, and I felt very pleased that I had the chance to understand it so completely and follow any tangent, really, that came up. I whistling records of the turn of the century, I spent a good few weeks learning about them. It's pretty amazing.
My guest is Lenny Kaye. His new book is called You Call It Madness, The Sensuous Song of the Croon. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Lenny Kaye. He's played guitar with Patti Smith since she started performing, and he produced the garage band anthology Nuggets. His new book, You Call It Madness, is about Russ Colombo and other crooners of the 1930s. I'm wondering if you hear early rock and rollers differently now, and if you hear a crooning influence in their voice that you didn't hear before. And I'm talking about the people who came of age before rock and roll but ended up performing it as the early performers. I'm thinking specifically of Elvis.
Well, to me, there would be no Elvis without Bing Crosby. Certainly, my love can understand you, you know, all that stuff. It's complete Bing, and it's a kind of root that is, A, ironic because Bing Crosby hated Elvis, but also he said that Elvis never contributed anything to popular music. Well, that's, you know, one side of a generation gap. But basically, you know, someone like Elvis, someone like Roy Orbison, the more romantic singers.
Let's hear another performer from the period. You write a lot about Rudy Vallee in your book.
And now there's a nut.
What do you find nutty about him?
Well, first of all, he was just a total girl hound. I mean, He was the kind of guy who would walk down the street and just, you know, keep running into telephone poles because he'd be craning his neck. He toward the end of his life, he wanted to write a book called Dolls of the Valley, where he talked about his conquests through the ages. But he's just a really funny guy, quite a character. And one of the funniest things I found in the book was his relationship with this woman named Faye Webb, who he married in 1931, about the same time that Russ came from California to New York. And, you know, his incredible, her infidelities, his infidelities, and their divorce proceedings, their getting back together proceedings. It really, he's a funny guy.
Before he sang with a microphone, Rudy Vallee used to sing with a megaphone. And that's like, if you know anything about Rudy Vallee, that's probably like the one thing
that's hysteria
that you know. And I remember, I think like when I was growing up in a lot of the old like Warner Brothers cartoons, there'd be a character mm-hmm. singing into a megaphone. What do you actually like about Rudy Vallee's singing?
Well, he has a beautiful voice for a start. It's a lot higher than Russ's baritone.
Mm-hmm.
He's kind of almost like a precursor to what I call the croon, which is, to me, the croon is like wordless singing. It's singing that's beyond language. It's when you have so much in your heart to say that you can't say it in actual words. You have to go, ba-ba-ba-ba. It's like the language of love. Rudy Vallee had such a beautiful voice and such a great taste in song that you really, you know, his voice almost breaks down into its syllables. He's not as croon-oriented as Russ Colombo or Bing, and actually the croon became almost a cliche within two or three years of its invention. A crooner moved from being this thing that somebody thought of and invented, this kind of, it's almost like scat singing. Became like a kind of cliche, not unlike the movement of any genre, you know, where you have the breakthroughs where things are exciting and then people really understand it and kind of jump on the bandwagon and then it's time to move on to something else. But the heyday of the croon really is, it's the voice really as musical instrument. It's very understandable, even if you don't know what the singer is saying. because you can understand the tone, the notes, the inflections. And that to me is what the croon is about. It's this, it's this sense of higher language, the language that's so overflowing in your heart that you just have to break into song.
Well, let's hear a 1933 Rudy Valley recording, and this is Orchids in the Moonlight. It's a song that was in the Fred Astaire movie Flying Down to Rio, but Rudy Valley had the popular recording of it. So why don't we hear it?
When orchids bloom in the moonlight and lovers vow to be true, I can still dream in the moonlight of one dear night that we knew. When orchids fade in the dawning, they speak of tears and goodbye. Though my dreams are shattered like the petals scattered, still my love can never die. There is peace in the twilight when the day is through, but the shadows that fall only seem to recall all my longing for you. There's a dream in the moonbeams upon a sea of blue, but the moonbeams that fall only seem to recall love is all, love is you.
That's Rudy Valley, recorded in 1933, Orchids in the Moonlight, and my guest is Lenny Kaye. And although Lenny Kaye is best known as Patti Smith's guitarist, long-term guitarist, and also well known for producing Nuggets, the Garage Band anthologies, his new book is about crooners of the 1930s. And the book is called You Call It Madness, The Sensuous Song of the Croon. And Rudy Valley, Russ Colombo, and Bing Crosby are three of the main characters in this book. So, Lenny, I'm wondering, was Rudy Valley a hard sell to your friends? I mean, when your friends were finding out that you were going home and listening to Rudy Valley records, did they think that was surprising?
That I lost my mind?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah, most people didn't quite get
I like Rudy
what
Valley.
I
should
doing.
Say that. I actually...
I like him, too. I think he's a very funny guy. But I really enjoyed, like, trailing these people because, you know, you think of them as very grandfatherly, and really they were young and wild, and especially at this time when all this music was being invented. I particularly like Orchids in the Moonlight because one of the dominant themes in the book is the sense of the night. To me, crooning takes place after the sun goes down.
Lenny Kaye, his new book is called You Call It Madness. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Harcourt, publishers of The Red Queen, the new novel by Margaret Drabble, author of The Seven Sisters and The Peppered Moth. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the twist of fate that ended crooner Russ Colombo's life. We continue our conversation with Lenny Kaye. Also, novelist Russell Bangs on why temperament trumps ideology. His new novel, The Darling, is about a former member of the radical group The Weather Underground.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Lenny Kaye. He's played guitar with Patti Smith since she started performing. He also produced the influential garage band anthology Nuggets. His new book, You Call It Madness, The Sensuous Song of the Croon, is about Russ Colombo and other crooners of the 1930s, like Bing Crosby and Rudy Valley. Here's Russ Colombo's 1931 recording, You Call It Madness, I Call It Love.
I can't forget the night I met you. That's all I'm dreaming of. And you call it madness. Ah, but I call it love. You made a promise to be faithful. By all the stars above, and you call it madness. Ah, but I call it love. I keep repeating, my heart is beating for you constantly. You're all I'm needing. And so I'm pleading, please come back to me. You made a plaything out of romance. What do you know of love? And you called it madness. Ah, but I call it love.
When the crooner started singing romantic ballads in a much smaller voice than performers could have had before, because that small voice couldn't fill a big theater,
right?
Was that kind of smaller, almost whispery, romantic voice ever seen as effeminate?
Yes, it was, and very much so. In fact, someone like Rudolph Valentino, who was regarded as probably the most romantic figure of the early 1920s. In fact, Russ Colombo was often called Valentino of song. There was quite a scandal about him, whether he was effeminate. And, you know, even when he wore a wristwatch, this was an effeminate symbol. To me, the croon is the male singing to the female in her language. It requires a sense of becoming female, of bending the knee to the female. You know, we're dealing in kind of strange stereotypes here and kind of gender characteristics, but I think, to me, what someone like Russ Colombo did was sing to a woman in her own language, and then he has permission to enter her world.
Early in the interview, you said one of the things that first interested you in Russ Colombo, and this is what led you into this whole era of the crooner, was finding out the kind of tabloid circumstances behind his death. Tell us the story of how he died.
Well, you couldn't make it up. I mean, that's what really impressed me the first time I heard it. He's visiting a friend of his. He's about to marry, perhaps, the actress Carol Lombard, who would call him the love of her life, even after she was with Clark Gable. His first starring movie was about to be released. He had gone to the preview. And he went over to visit a friend of his, a Hollywood photographer named Lansing Brown, and on the table are two antique dueling pistols. During the course of this conversation, Lansing lights a match in the percussion pen of one of these dueling pistols. There's a sudden explosion. A long-forgotten bullet explodes, ricochets off the table, and strikes Russ Colombo in the left eye. And I'm thinking, wow, I'm just imagining that bullet waiting there for 60 or 70 years for its moment, and Russ Colombo being in the exact place for that bullet to strike him. The hindsight of fate is how I refer to it. It's pretty it's pretty spooky. And then I hear, as this announcer is talking, of that because his mother was very ill when he suddenly died, they kept his death from her, and for the next 10 years, they would write letters from all over the world to her saying, "Dear Mom, I'm in Barcelona. I'm held over. I'm going to Paris. Hope to be home for Christmas, but maybe not." And for 10 years, they, like, sent these letters from him, kind of from the beyond. And that also, I thought, wow, that's so strange. It's like having a lifeline past your own lifeline.
How old was he when he was shot?
26.
It's really young.
Really young, and had lived quite a life. Had come to New York, got on the radio, been a big star, lost his money, gained his money, participated in the era. One of the things I liked about Russ was that he kind of moved through the major cultural moment, kind of attracting personalities to him. Benny Goodman, before Benny Goodman was the king of swing, organized a band for Russ, so I could see exactly what it was that Benny Goodman did that made him so important in American culture. These are things that I didn't know when I started. I wanted to see what Benny Goodman was like in 1932 and what made him, you know, gather the bare bones of swing together and really become the king of the music of the late 30s.
Well, Lenny, I'd love to close with a song. Would you perform another one for us?
I'd like to. I thought I would do, since we did a song of Bing's and a song of Russ's, this is a song that, well, all of them recorded, but Rudy Valley was the one that snagged a piece of the publishing. I'm not sure that he deserved it, but that was in those days, you know. If you introduced a song, you could put your name on the writer's credit. And this is really a beautiful song. It kind of closes just about any show. It's called "Good Night, Sweetheart." And I'm sure you've heard it. This is almost in the common currency. Good night, sweetheart, till we meet tomorrow. Good night, sweetheart, sleep will banish sorrow. Tears and parting may make us forlorn, but with the dawn, a new day is born. So I'll say, good night, sweetheart, though I'm not beside you. Good night, sweetheart, still my love will guide you. Dreams enfold you, in each one I will hold you. So good night, sweetheart, good night. Rudy Valley.
Lenny Kaye, thank you so much.
Oh, it's a total pleasure, Terry. I really... I like revealing this world. It's very sweet, and there's something very warming about it.
Lenny Kaye's new book is called You Call It Madness, The Sensuous Song of the Croon. Coming up, Russell Banks talks about his new novel, The Darling. It's about a former member of the Weather Underground. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Russell Banks, is the author of Affliction and The Sweet Hereafter, which have both been adapted into films. He was recently named president of the North American Network of Cities of Asylum, an international organization which provides refuge for writers whose lives are threatened in their own countries. Banks' new novel, The Darling, is about a woman, Hannah Musgrave, who in the 60s was a member of the radical group The Weather Underground. Tired of living underground as a fugitive under the name Dawn Carrington, she moved to West Africa, where she married a Liberian and got caught in the country's civil war. The novel begins years later in America when she decides to return to Africa, and we learn the story of what happened to her family there. Reviewing The Darling in the New York Times Sunday Book Review, Mary Gordon described the book as a symphony of history, politics, and impossible failed dreams. Here's a short reading in which Hannah is describing why she married her husband.
So what was it about Woodrow Sundiata that brought me to believe that I had fallen in love with him and that made me, after a few short months, decide to marry him? My initial attraction had been mostly sexual, and within weeks, once I got used to his rigid, nearly expressionless face and constricted manners, had weakened somewhat. I no longer saw him as an African samurai. What exactly, then, did I see in him, other than a benefactor and protector? If it wasn't the color of his skin, perhaps it was the fact that he was African, that he was pointedly not American. In those years, I was bone weary of my war against everything American. The war against American racism, the war against the Vietnam War, the war against the system, all of it. It felt like I'd been at war my entire life, even as a child and adolescent waging the war against my parents. I hadn't realized it until after I'd left Ghana and Zach, my last links to the movement. But by the time I arrived in Monrovia, I was, in a sense, shell-shocked.
That's Russell Banks reading from his new novel, The Darling. I'm interested in that sense that she describes in that paragraph of being perpetually at war against parents, at war against the war in Vietnam, against racism, against the system. Would you talk a little bit more about that sense of being constantly at war?
Well, I think what I was trying to get to there is that anyone, well, particularly, let's say, Hannah Musgrave, who is anyone who is as profoundly engaged in moral combat as she is throughout her adult life and youth even, is there because of a whole braid of motives. I mean, some of it's psychological and familial, some of it is situational and historical, some of it is ideological, and some of it is simply and purely moral principles. And it pervades everything. It isn't just, you know, one or two issues. It's temperament. At some point, she says, temperament trumps ideology. And I think that's what I was trying to get to. What makes up temperament? And her temperament happens to be that of somebody who is in combat.
Her father is a famous doctor, and her family is very prosperous. Mm-hmm. She's very guilty about her sense of privilege, mm-hmm. about the family of privilege and entitlement that she was born into, and I think that's part of her reason for becoming a radical.
Yeah, class guilt, privilege guilt. That, and you know, I don't want to dismiss or step around the real historical circumstances, too. I mean, we mustn't forget this is the late 60s, early 70s, and that was a particular historical situation, and a lot of people reacted to it as well. I mean, it isn't just simply reducible to her family dynamic, although that's certainly a factor at play. I mean, that was one of the things I was trying to get to, Terry, in the book, was the complex net of motivations that operate so that we don't just simply reduce someone like Hannah, or even that an entire generation, to a kind of caricature. You know, it's funny right now, of course, with the election, we're refighting the whole culture war and Vietnam War in many ways over positions taken by, say, John Kerry and George Bush, or not taken in that era. And we're reducing our analysis of those two men and everyone around them, really, to one or two motives or one or two impulses or reasons for taking a position or not taking a position, when in fact there are dozens and dozens of them. And in a sense, I guess, a novel can get at those, that net, that cluster of motives in a much better way than most of us do through the through journalism or other kinds of accounts.
So what about you? What was the closest you came to becoming part of a larger radical group in the 60s or 70s?
Probably formally, the closest I came was in organizing the SDS, Students for Democratic Society chapter at Chapel Hill when I was at college. And But then that was about as far to the left, as far to within an organization that I actually got.
Now, I read about you. Tell me if this is accurate, that there was a period when you were thinking of joining Castro's Revolutionary Army.
Yeah. Well, I made my feeble attempt at that. I was, after all, 18 years old, and Castro, this was 1958, Terry, and that time Castro was a romanticized figure on the cover of Life magazine called Dr. Castro, and he was like a Robin Hood, portrayed as a sort of Robin Hood figure in the mountain fastness of the Sierra Maestra, and I hitchhiked out of New England on my way south to join Castro, and got about as far as Miami in the winter of 58-59. In February, Castro marched into Havana and no longer needed me, needed this 18-year-old boy who couldn't speak Spanish to come to his side. So I got a job moving furniture in a hotel, and my life took on a different kind of swirl.
I want to ask you about the relationship that you've created for your main character with the African who she marries.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in the United States, when she's living underground, she becomes so disillusioned with men that she has an affair with another woman, and neither of them really think of themselves as lesbians. They're just mm-hmm. both kind of tired and fed up with relationships with men
for
the moment, and lonely, yeah.
Yeah.
But in Africa, in Liberia, with the man who she marries, she puts up with things that she'd probably never consider putting up with the mm-hmm. States, relating mm-hmm. to birth control and, mm-hmm. You know, gender roles and...
Fidelity, yes.
Fidelity, yes. Tell me why you created that predicament for her.
Well, I didn't have a plan, and that's in as much as it evolved, and I was aware of the fact that she's like a changeling, and that she's an extremely adaptable person, perhaps too adaptable in many ways, and keeps moving through identities depending upon the people that enter her life. There's a great story, actually, where the title that the title of the book alludes to, "The Darling," by Chekhov, and it's about a woman who is a changeling, and I've always been deeply moved by that story because it's extremely compassionate towards a character that might otherwise be easily dismissed by almost any one of us, and I feel this way about Hannah Musgrave too, because she is a woman who moves through identities and in a kind of constant quest for authenticity, and none of them quite fit her. And the the role that she ends up playing in Woodrow Sundiata's life, or the role he ends up playing in her life, perhaps, creates an identity for her that is, in a sense, fresh and new. Even even though it's in profound conflict with the identity that she wore as Don Carrington, in the Weather Underground, or earlier on as kind of this proto-feminist adolescent named Scout. It was part and parcel of her character, Terry. That's really how it came about. And it wasn't that I had a plan or a scheme or a message, for that matter.
My guest is Russell Banks. His new novel is called The Darling. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Russell Banks. His new novel, The Darling, is about a member of the Weather Underground who becomes tired of living as a fugitive and moves to West Africa, where she marries a Liberian and gets caught in the country's civil war. Your character of Hannah is a radical who comes from a very privileged background. Mm-hmm. You were a radical who came from a very working-class background.
Right.
And I'm wondering, when you met people like Hannah in your real life, what you made of the fact that they were from very comfortable backgrounds and now were now voluntarily, you know, identifying with the working class, living a life with little or no money and few comforts. Did that make sense to you? Did you think of them as being, like, less authentic or more fake or, you know, just...
Yeah. Well, yeah, I did back then. I mean, one of the reasons, actually, I wrote this book, I think, you know, now that it's done and I'm looking at it, I can see it more or less as a reader and less as a writer, and I can say, well, why was I doing that, and see what's on the page and reason backwards from it. And I think one of the things I was trying to do was to avoid or to step around and maybe get away from the stereotyping of someone from Hannah's class, because I did do that. The biggest stretch for me was not that she was a woman, but that she was from a privileged background, and I'm not. And so I did have to come to a kind of compassionate understanding of the melange of motivations and forces that were at play in her life. I couldn't just simply stereotype her the way, in fact, I did stereotype people from her background who went into radical politics, did as a young man and well into my adult life. And it took me perhaps until now. I don't think I could have written this book with the kind of sympathy. I've written a book about a character like Hannah with the kind of sympathy, with the kind of compassion and, I hope, understanding that I managed to write it now, these many years later.
When you were a young man, do you feel like you tried on different identities through the desire to or the need to?
You know, I think I sidestepped some of that, a lot of that, really, because by having committed myself fairly early on, and really in my early 20s, to a life of writing, to dedication to an art, in a way, and bending my life to the discipline and rigors of that. Having done that, you know, fairly early in my, you know, as I say, in my early 20s, that really kind of created an identity for me that was flexible enough and yet fixed enough and had enough models and examples in front of me that I didn't go through the kind of shape changing, certainly, that Hannah goes through, and that a lot of people, most people, go through. So I didn't have a midlife crisis, as it were. I didn't have, you know, a career change or a sudden desire to go out and buy a red Porsche and so on in my 40s. I more or less evolved out of that early, you know, format, which was really because of my time and my era, rather, and the models that were around me was more or less formed out of, you know, male writers who preceded me.
So tell me more about how you think writing saved you from that kind of shape-changing or midlife crisis.
Well, it saved me from a lot of troubles, actually, because I was a very turbulent and angry young man. And it gave my life a real meaning. Storytelling, writing, put me under a kind of discipline and focus that I couldn't really have achieved any other way. I mean, I might have achieved it had I become a Zen Buddhist and dedicated my life to that practice, or who knows, you know, done 10 years of psychotherapy or something. But it had the effect, really, of stopping me and making me sit down and pay attention to the world and to my perceptions of the world, and put me under the discipline of a craft, of an art that really had the effect of saving my life and probably saving someone else's life as well.
Do you ever look back at your younger self as if you were a fictional creation and ask yourself, what was it that shaped the violent side of the personality?
Sure, I think so. I've learned a lot from writing fiction on just about why and how people do the things they do. And so naturally, I I've applied whatever I've learned from writing to my own life. It's a form of, I guess, autotherapy or something. But certainly, you know, if Hannah Musgrave does what she does for a multitude of reasons, from, you know, historical and ideological to personal and familial and so forth, then I do too, whatever I do, for a myriad of reasons. And so I can sort of untangle that braid in the same way in myself, in the same way I can untangle the braid in Hannah's life.
And I fear it would be too reductionist for me to ask you to untangle that particular braid. Yes? Should I not? I mean, I hesitate. I just feel like I'm going to ask you to be giving a simplistic answer about why you were that way. So I hesitate to ask.
Why I was this turbulent, angry, and violent young man?
Yeah, is that?
No, I can answer that. I think that there's a whole lot of reasons, though, and I can't just simply reduce it and say because my father was an alcoholic and was violent, which happens to be true, or because I was born into a working-class family where male physical violence was, if not celebrated, was certainly admired in certain ways, or because I was born in 1940 and my parents were Depression-era parents and I was born into a patriarchal family, I'm very much a male-dominated family. Those are all at play. The time and place that I was born, northern New England, 1940, was a factor. Growing up in the war years and then the late 40s and early 50s was a fact. They were factors. All those things were at play. So I'm. You're right. I mean, I am avoiding a simple reductive answer to it. The way I would avoid a simple reductive answer as to why Hannah behaved the way she behaves.
Well, Russell Banks, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Terry. It's great to be here.
Russell Banks' new novel is called The Darling. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Lauren Krenzel. I'm Terry Gross. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Weird U.S., your travel guide to America's local legends and best-kept secrets, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Daedalus Books, Remainders for Readers, Holiday Catalog at 800-395-2665, or SALEBOOKS.com. And from the National Endowment for the Arts, this is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, two editorial page editors who are getting huge responses to their endorsements. The Philadelphia Inquirer is publishing 21 editorials over 21 days in support of John Kerry. The Chicago Tribune is endorsing President Bush in a traditionally Democratic city. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.